Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch, the podcast where I chat to magnificent people over equally magnificent food. My guest today has always been close to the stars. He started in a rock band called Dare and decided to jack it all in for a life in academia, teaching particle physics and studying astronomy, as you do. But he couldn't stay out of the spotlight and came to prominence once more as presenter of hit BBC science shows like The Wonders of the Solar System and Stargazing Live. His name and voice have become so well known in the UK that University Challenge poses questions on him, and he's voiced a character in Postman Pat. Oh, and he works at CERN, lectures at Manchester University, and is fellow of the Royal Society. It is, of course, Professor Brian Cox.
Yeah, I think what I was basically saying was I wouldn't consider moving to the moon until until the Ramignans, I think is my point.
Brian.
Hello, Jay. How are you?
You can hear me. How marvellous. How marvellous. Yeah. Now, listen, normally on Out to Lunch, we ask people for their dietary requirements and they come back and say, I don't eat dairy or I'm a fruitarian or whatever. It's fine. You know, we cater for all sorts. You were very specific. You said, I am led by my wine choices. I like white burgundies. Well, we better deal with that. Now, you should have got a delivery. I think it came yesterday.
I have had a delivery, yeah.
Do you want to read the label or shall I?
Yeah, can you see it? So it's a Saint-Aubin Premier Cru 2018 from Jean-Claude Boissy.
Yes, indeed. Just so you don't feel too special, I've also got one. I mean, the last thing I was going to do was let you do it. Now, it came from Liberty Wines, which happens to be, I don't know if you know this, they're just around the corner from you.
How did I not know that?
I don't know. David there, who runs it, and I had dealt with each other on something else, and I said, would you mind? And he went, oh, of course. So the notes that we have describe this wine as a kind of combination of Puligny and Chasnay in a glass. So I definitely know that your food is heading your way. Between you and I is a lovely Spanish restaurant called Boqueria, which is on Acre Lane. And so they have already delivered to me and are now just in Brixton, and they're now working their way towards you. Yeah. Have you had a sip?
Well, that's just perfect, right up my street.
Well, marvellous. For your starter, I'll tell you the starter first, then we'll move on to the main. You should have Padron peppers, but of course, King Prawn croquettes. And I have the equivalent, which is a chicken and ham croquette.
This is tremendous.
Food-wise, before I circle back on you, you just did an episode, well, close to when we're talking, of Infinite Monkey Cage, about the science of food and cooking, with Harold McGee and some charlatan pretending to be a food critic called Grace Dick. And you said that you rather love a meat probe. I'm just curious. I just want to test your knowledge. What temperature internally do you want to get to in a piece of beef or lamb to get to medium rare?
Following McGee, I let it go to about 56 and then let it rest for a minute, and a few minutes. And so it goes a little bit higher probably. But I cook it to 56.
56 is exactly where it's meant to be for medium rare. So I'm, you get a salute from me.
Last year, I was in France. I was obviously, if I ever drive through France, I stop in Beaune or Meursault or somewhere like that, because why wouldn't you? And I went in this little shop in Meursault, and it was one of those wonderful local wine shops. And I just said to him, the old guy there, and I said, look, I'm in your hands. I love Meursault. Just give me a selection of wines from the village. And so he sussed me out for a bit and worked out how much I wanted to spend and gave me some wine.
did he look at you and go, he's an internationally renowned
physicist?
No,
he really didn't
do that.
He absolutely neither knew nor cared who I was, because he was a wine dealer in Meursault, right? So he just didn't care. But at the end, I said to him, do you decant them? And he said, yes, you should decant the white burgundies, right? He said you should open them at breakfast if you're going to have them at dinner. So that was interesting. And I said, what temperature should I serve at? And I said, because I've got my temperature. I usually put them about 9 degrees in my fridge. And he said, what? 9 is for water. They shouted it at me. 9 is for water. And so I said, what temperature should I do it at? And he said, 11. So he was livid that I would, you know, drink this wine at 9 degrees. He thought it should be
at
11.
But it should be at 11.
But he said, I loved it when he said 9 is for water. Just this dismissive, absolutely dismissed me out of hand. He almost threw me out of the shop.
What was it about being a pop star that attracted?
I started going to gigs. I just thought, I want to do that. I think I must have been 14. I mean, we'd had a little band before that, but as I said, I was just into geeky electronic music and Kraftwerk and things like that.
It does sound like it all happened very, very easily and very quickly.
You invent all these reasons, I think, afterwards, why you managed to get somewhere that was reasonably successful. But I think my whole career, in everything, right, in music and physics and television, there's been a tremendous amount of luck all the way through. And so the luck, in terms of getting into a professional band, what was the keyboard player from Thin Lizzy, happened bizarrely to have bought a house in Oldham. And my dad had given him a demo tape. He remembered when he was putting a band together and thought there's a guy up the road who looks reasonable and says he can play keyboards, I'll invite him for an audition. And I managed to join the band.
Did you listen to a lot of albums and then start picking things out?
Yeah.
On the keys? It's not simple.
But also there was a component of the fact that I could work the technology. So I think he was quite attracted to the fact that no matter how bad I was at playing at the time, I could at least turn it on and I could manage all those keyboards at the back of the set, you know, so I could just stand there and twiddle the knobs.
Were you very rock and roll? I mean, one of the great rock and roll stories I've heard you tell is going to Disneyland straight off a plane and losing your car.
Yeah, we did that. We were rock and roll in the sense that, you know, apart from Darren, we were four other guys from Oldham, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old. So we started recording at Hook End Manor, as it was then, which had been Jimmy Page's house, which was amazing because it was in Henley and it was, wow. But then they said, we're going to finish it in LA. You know, I hadn't set foot out of the country. So suddenly you find yourself from Oldham transplanted in LA with a big record deal with A&M Records. And so there is going to be an element of rock and rollness, because I challenge anybody who's 18 or 19 to be transplanted to California in the late 80s with essentially what feels like unlimited money. It wasn't, you know, but it felt like, you know, because I'd never earned a penny in my life. It wasn't like Led Zeppelin rock and roll, you know, because we didn't, sure. It was...
You didn't have your own jet.
No. I'm going to have one more mouthful of this tremendous artichoke. Mm. It works really well. I pause for a minute and savour these flavors.
The wine works really well with the
artichoke. It really does. It's beautiful. What happened was Dare split up. I'd always wanted to be an astronomer, basically. And all through the tours, I'd kind of still read a few physics books and things. So
Were you literally sitting on tour buses with books by whoever, you know, Fenneman and whatever?
Yeah, reading about Einstein and things like that. And so I came back and I immediately applied to Manchester University. And so I got in, but I think it was October when I applied or something, so I had a year to wait. I needed a job. My friend, who was a sound engineer, said, well, just I've got this band I've been working with, and they're not going anywhere. It's really annoying, that dancey kind of stuff. So why don't you just do that? So I spent a year driving D-Ream up and down the motorway to gigs. And then D-Ream got a record deal, and Peter Cunner, who's still a really close friend of mine, said, we've got a TV slot, I think, on some late night TV show. So just play the keyboards. So I accidentally joined the band and in a sense stayed in it all the way through, except that I was also at university. And so that's what I did with D-Ream. I just appeared when I could. And then we got back together in 97 for the Blair election, you know, things can only get better. And that's the last time. So we did a Top of the Pops that night, and that was a great way for me to end my time with D-Ream.
Given that you've raised the New Labour election victory in 97, yeah, and Blair's involvement in the use of the song, things can only get better. How would you respond to the suggestion that you lied to us, you lying fuckers? Here we are in 2021, and I would argue they have not got better.
I always joke about it, that it's physically inaccurate, because things get worse. It's called the second law of
thermodynamics. Because of entropy.
Yeah, so entropy always increases. So, you know, obviously Blair's star waned somewhat, and we could, you know, go into all those reasons. But it's important to remember that at the time, in 97, it was a period of tremendous optimism. And I think indeed. Even John Major, I reckon, voted for Blair in that election.
Did you ever meet Blair as a
Many
result
times,
of doing that?
At the time, he wasn't Prime Minister. Like when we were doing those things would get better. He was just the leader of the opposition, wandering around doing rallies. And we did quite a lot of the rallies with New Labour. And so he was just there, and he'd come in the dressing room and have a chat, and John Prescott was there, and Mandelson, and all those people who became household names. But they weren't, I mean, you know, Blair was kind of a bit of a star then, but he wasn't prime minister. So there was no lack of access or any security to speak of or any of that stuff. I got to know them quite well, quite a few of them, actually, just because we did a lot of the rallies.
Did it feel like every time you went on stage to play that song at a rally that you were soundtracking an important moment?
Yeah, yeah, and it really was. You know, I think everyone of our generation remembers that speech, A New Day is Dawning, you know, that very famous speech, beautiful sunny day. And it just felt like Britain had turned a corner.
Shall I tell you what your main courses are? Are you still ploughing through your artichoke flowers?
It's all about making the wine work for me. The artichoke flowers work fantastically with it.
So for your main course, you have pork cheeks and patatas bravas. You might want to pick around the bravas bit, which is the sauce, because that might, again, blunt the burgundy. Whereas I have suckling pig with patatas bravas. Going back up right at the beginning, you go to university as a mature student, pretty much. I think you said you're 23.
That's right, yeah. That's great, by the way.
Oh, which bit are you on?
The pork.
Is it good?
It's got this lovely smoky thing with it, just a light smokiness to it.
At what point did you realise that you weren't merely indulging your own interest in physics, but that you were really, really good at it?
I don't think anyone thinks I'm really, really good at this.
Brian, you're Professor of Particle Physics at the University of Manchester, and there's an awful lot of people who've been through the undergraduate course at the University of Manchester in physics who are not.
Yeah, but they might not have wanted to. I mean, the thing is, what I found was that I could understand it if I worked hard, and I wanted to understand it. So particularly with maths, I mean, I wasn't good at maths at school at all.
Didn't you get a D at A?
Yeah, I mean, and there's loads of reasons. I mean, one thing, I'd already joined the band by that point, so I didn't think I was going to need it anyway. I was at a New Order gig the night before, the A-level, actually. So, you know, but broadly speaking, I wasn't very good at it. And what I found at university is that if I did some work and thought about it, I found a way of thinking about maths that allowed me to do it. But it was hard work. And some people are much more naturally able than I am at maths in particular. And if you're sufficiently interested and you find it interesting and fascinating, then you will find a way of thinking about it that suits you.
When television came your way, I know there were a whole bunch of episodes of Horizon before you did Wonders of the Solar System. Did you hesitate, or were you well up for it?
The thing is, in some ways, I didn't think about it so much, you know, because you don't think... I'd been interviewed a couple of times before that, mainly at CERN. Someone must have said, oh, he looks all right, and he does it. He can speak a bit, give him a little show. At the time, Horizon did that. It was tremendously important. It brought academics onto the screen and allowed you to learn. I've said that it's really important to learn your craft. Nobody's good at it initially. And so I just did it because I was asked, and they asked me to do one on time, I think, and one on gravity, and I just really enjoyed it. And then, you're right, then this big decision came when Wonders of the Solar System was offered to me, which was a huge series that required going to the university and saying, I've been offered this thing, it's going to take a year, so I really don't want to leave the university, I don't want to leave academia, can I do it? And the university were magnificent. I wouldn't have chosen television over academia.
I've done a fair bit of non-fiction or factual television in my time. It's an arduous process. I know your producer very, very well on Wonders of the Solar System. A friend of mine.
Was that Danielle?
Daniel Pegg.
Yeah, yeah. He's a fantastic producer.
You flew around the world three times, pretty much. I mean, you were shot everywhere. It became almost a joke. Where's he going to pop up next for the next piece of camera?
Because
did you enjoy that element of it, or was it an effing nightmare?
So the idea that you got this itinerary and it was all over the world, that was the reason the series worked in a way, because... if you think about making a series about space, but it's television, you've got to point the camera at something. And at the time, graphics were tremendously expensive. They're cheaper now. So you couldn't make a series just full of graphics.
So you made sandcastles in Namibia.
there was mainly Danielle and people out thinking, well, how do we make this interesting for an audience? How do we find something that you can point a camera at? And how can you put across these ideas? It's easy in a way... with a solar system series, because you want to talk about volcanoes, you go to a volcano. I mean, we went to the volcano in the world, which is the lava lake in northern Ethiopia. You know, it's just astonishing. And you can't go there now. It's one of the, you know, great privileges that there were other things going on at the time. The BBC were making a load of programs because it was the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society. So they'd had this year of science. So ours was a bit, no one really paid attention. We thought, we'll never get another one. It was like, you know, no one's going to pay these idiots again to go and make this series. So let's have a great time and just film what we want and do it the way that we want. And there it is. I was actually watching it, coincidentally, the other day, because we've been doing a little archive review thing to put on the BBC. And in some ways, it looks more creative than the stuff that I've done since. But part of it was that freedom. And the, to your question, it was because I didn't think it was a career. And I never have.
Right. 11 years on.
Yeah, I still don't. If someone says, what do you do? I say I'm a physicist at the University of Manchester and I do some teleprograms, but in that order.
Right. You see, there's another way of looking at it, which is you have found a way to be a rock star by another means.
I mean, in terms of live shows, I do these big live shows.
Yeah. Well, you went to the O2.
Well, exactly.
So, aren't you? Which is 2021, a space odyssey.
Yeah. So that, you're right.
October.
Those audiences, you know, 10,000 people or something. I never played to audiences that big. Even supporting Take That, I think we didn't, you know, with D-Ream, I didn't. And I supported Europe with Dare and Jimmy Page, actually, with Dare. It was a fantastic. We did some great tours. But even then, so you're right. If there's a sense in your question, did I want to be a rock star? I never did. I've answered it twice now. I didn't when I joined a band. I was just interested in the tech. The thing about science is that I like talking about it because I like it. I love it, right? I love physics and astronomy. And so it is a wonderful privilege to be able to talk about it and make a living out of it beyond the living you would make if you're just an academic. But if you said you choose, you don't make no more television or give no more lectures and do no more physics, I'd make no more television. There's no doubt about that.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
In the promotion for the O2 event, you recently said, and by the way, we may actually all be holograms and I'll just leave that there. You can't. You cannot leave that there. I refuse to allow that to just pass by.
This is the thing I'm most interested in at the moment. And it's to do with black holes, actually. Stephen Hawking, a long time ago now, back in the 1980s, asked a question which has been described as the most productive question in modern theoretical physics. And it's really simple. So you throw a book into a black hole. Is the information contained in the book lost forever from the universe? Do black holes destroy information? It's important because they evaporate, which again was Stephen Hawking's great contribution. So there's all this radiation, Hawking radiation, that's there instead of the black hole. The question is the information still there in the radiation? And you might say, well, that's not particularly interesting. Who cares? The thing is, it's fundamental in physics that information is not destroyed. That's determinism, right? So we take it as fundamental that if we knew everything, in your room now, we could measure the position and speed of every particle, everything that was in there. Then in principle, although not in practice, we could predict how that was going to change into the future and how it was back in the past. It's absolutely just a fundamental bedrock of physics. It's deterministic. Information is not destroyed. And it looked for many years as if black holes destroyed information. And in the last couple of years, we seem to have been able to answer it to an extent. And the quick answer is they don't. Put it this way. The question was asked, what happens if you put one bit of information into a black hole? How does the black hole store it? How does it keep it? What happens to it? The answer is the black hole expands a bit, but it expands such that the surface area of the so-called event horizon around the black hole expands by a very important amount. It's called one square Planck unit. A Planck unit is the smallest distance that you can define sensibly in physics. So that's telling you the information is stored on the surface, because there's a complete correspondence between throwing information into the black hole and the surface area of the black hole. So it's like having a library and saying, how much information can you get in a library? How many books? And you would say, well, it's to do with the volume, isn't it? Obviously, I fill the library with books. But it's not. It's as if in nature, at the most fundamental level, you're only allowed to paper the outside of the library. So it's strongly suggestive that there isn't really an interior. You know, if you think about it, the most information you can get into a particular bit of space is proportional to the surface area of that bit of space and not the volume, and that seems to be true, then it does imply that there's a description of the universe, which is a hologram, because that's what a hologram is. A hologram is a flat piece of film, but you can, all the information is there to reconstruct a three-dimensional thing, and you can walk around the three-dimensional thing and look at it. It's all there, but it's actually encoded on a flat surface. And that seems to be the way the
universe is. So you're saying we're living in a two-dimensional world, not a three-dimensional world?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the world's four-dimensional, so it would be less than that. But yes, it's in one less, five, it's one six. Less dimension. The bottom line is it looks like space and time are not fundamental things, that they emerge from a deeper description. So this piece of pork, which is excellent, it's, what is it? It's made of atoms, right? And the atoms, the protons and things have been around since the Big Bang, and they've been made in stars and so on, but they're atoms. And so there's nothing porky about the atoms, right? There's a deeper description of this, which has got nothing to do with pork, right?
Okay.
And in the same way, it seems that space and time have a deeper description in which they don't exist. So with that thing, I mean, time particularly, that's the most evocative of things, this thing that passes and we get older as time goes on and the years pass by. That looks like it's coming from something else, which is just basically at the bottom level, information. It's often been said that in the 20th century, it looked like if there was a God, God was a mathematician, because the laws of physics are mathematical. Now it's beginning to look like the laws of physics are information-based. So it's about information, quantum information, and how it works. And so God, if there's a God, God's a computer programmer. But that doesn't mean that we're living in a simulation. It's no more nor less surprising than the statement that God is a mathematician. It might be very surprising, or it might not be surprising. You can't really infer anything other than that's what nature is.
You have declined to be drawn on the questions of godness or not. I'm a head-banging atheist, for what it's worth. But you seem to feel that it's not something necessarily that you should have a view on, despite your involvement in physics.
I think the great strength of free societies like ours is that there are lots of people who have different views. I have a platform of sorts, and I think it's an unnecessary debate. It doesn't seem to get anywhere to me. We don't even know if the universe had a beginning in time, right? We know there was a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. It probably was an event in a pre-existing universe. And we don't know how long that universe existed for. It could be eternal. And I once gave a talk at a, a conference of Catholic bishops, and they asked me to give a talk on cosmology. And I said, yeah, okay. And at the end, I posed that question, the question which is, what place for God in an eternal universe? I don't know. It's kind of interesting to me. And they didn't know either.
Listen, do you fancy some dessert?
Yeah, I'm going to have one more mouthful of this because it's terrific.
You really have a tarta de Santiago.
Oh, here it is.
I've gone for the cheesecake.
I've got almond cake, it says on it.
Yeah, tarta de Santiago. That's what I thought it was.
This wine is terrific, by the way.
Well, I'm delighted. Well, we've done a bit of physics, and there is one thing. I mean, you said, actually, we've got to get off the planet, not just occasionally, not just one or two of us, lots of us. And that's going to require lots of developments. I'm kind of intrigued by what some weird, very rich men are doing.
Yeah.
Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. You have said you would consider moving to the moon, but there aren't any vineyards.
Yeah, I think what I was basically saying was I wouldn't consider moving to the moon until until there are vineyards, I think is what I
was saying.
Oh, okay. You know, there's no way in which we're going to replace this one. Jeff Bezos, I've had the pleasure of interviewing him, and he's an interesting guy, as you would expect, I suppose, and very easy to talk to. Elon is a bit, I've also spoken to him, he's a bit more difficult to talk to. What Jeff Bezos said, the Earth is the best planet we know of anywhere in the universe. And that's almost by definition, because we evolved on it. So it's a perfect planet for us. Therefore, we need to protect it. That's why his rocket company is called Blue Origin, by the way, because it's referring to this beautiful blue planet we have. If you want to protect it, then resources are important. And so it's clear that we're damaging the planet in the search for more resources and the search for expansion. There are infinite resources out there in the sky. Even in the asteroid belt, there's a vast amount of resources. So it's not entirely ridiculous to come to the conclusion that it might be worth utilizing some of the resources that exist off the planet in order to save the planet. And that's basically his position. I find it hard to refute that logic.
You talked about Bezos and Elon Musk as we head towards the end of our lunch together. Is that one of the real perks of your job, that you get to meet people? I've seen you light up when meeting, you know, astronauts, the ones who've actually been to space. Is that the joy?
Yeah. I mean, in particular, astronauts, you're right.
Is that the literal definition of being a starfucker?
I think there's only one person I can remember meeting who I've ever been completely starstruck by and couldn't speak, and it was Neil Armstrong. I've met quite a few. I've been so lucky, as you say, to meet quite a few Apollo astronauts and become quite friendly with a couple of them. And they're all impressive individuals, and I worship them as a kid, you know, so that they're all stars to me. But Armstrong was something else for some reason. And I shook his hand and I just couldn't say anything. I never met David Bowie. I think I might have been like that with David Bowie. I don't know. But
Weren't you meant to interview Neil Armstrong?
No. I met him at a Royal Society event. It was just one of those things where it was just hello. And it was one of those that I just couldn't say. And I shook his hand and I was so astonished. I was holding his hand. And it's weird because I know that Apollo was a big collective effort. And there's no special Apollo astronauts. They were all, you know, the same, basically. And it was fairly random who got chosen to be the first person on the moon. But I couldn't say anything. And I've met some remarkable people over the years.
Well, I'm sure I'm one of them. Listen, Brian, it's been fantastic. I'm hoping you've still got a bit left in your bottle.
I really do. You can probably tell I'm still relatively coherent. Well, I don't know, do I?
You're properly coherent. You're brilliantly coherent. All that really remains for me to say is, Professor Brian Cox, thank you very much for staying in for lunch for me or going out to lunch, whichever way around we say it. I hope this will not, you know, add to the entropy that is coming to us all when we reach our 50s.
Oh, it will. It will. We've expended energy doing this. We've increased. We've speeded up the demise of the universe in our own special way and little way.
Well, I'm glad to be a part of something. I I think I held my own when it comes to the wonders of the universe. Thank you to Brian for explaining everything so patiently. What a brilliant man. And Brian and I were well lubricated by a fine white burgundy from Liberty Wines. We paired that with fantastic Spanish food, thanks to the restaurant Boqueria, which has outposts in both Brixton and Battersea in South London. And remember, do rate, comment and share to spread the word. It helps us to make more of these brilliant chats for your listening pleasure. Why not 5 stars? You know it makes sense. Do follow us wherever you get your podcasts so that new editions arrive with you the minute they come out of the oven. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording engineer was Gulliver Tickle and the mix engineer was Josh Gibbs. Jemima Rathbone was assistant producer. The producer is Selena Ream and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Additional production is from Steve Ackerman. Next time, it's the Band of Brothers, Homeland and Billions actor. It's Damian Lewis.
And all these young American lads arrived in England. You know, they'd been in the gym, they'd been working out, and they were ready. You know, Spielberg and Hanks were launching this big thing, and they wanted to know who the fucking limey was that was going to play this hero who none of them had ever heard of.